Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Alicia Campbell. I'm here on behalf of the appellant. And just to provide you a little bit of framework here, my husband and I are splitting time, so I'm going to be talking about the constitutional and jurisdictional issues that exist in this case. And I'm going to do that for about 8 minutes, and then he's going to come through with the standing and any remaining issues.
What about the procedural issues?
I will be covering those, Your Honor.
About the 10-day rule, about you?
Yes, Your Honor. I'll be happy to answer your questions on those.
But go ahead. So start with your argument. I just want to mention that as part of the issues we're going to deal with.
Go ahead. When I met Mr. Truong, he came into my office and said, "Ms. Campbell, can you help me? I think there's been a mistake made here." And with him, he brought documents that we began to go through. And as I looked at them, I saw what he meant. He had been in a modification in which he made the 3 required payments. And after those 3 payments were made, he made 4 additional payments, with the last payment being made on August 3rd of 2010. In his mail on August 4th was a document that said, "Hey, good job. Let's make this permanent. Nice job making your payments." On August 4th, he also received a letter from Citi that said, "This letter will serve as notice that your mortgage is still in default. All reasonable efforts afforded you to cure this default have failed." And so he did not know what to do, and he said, "Can you help me, Ms. Campbell?" And I said, "I would like to. I'm just as confused by this as you." He had all his bank statements indicating payments. So the first thing I had to do was explain, "Mr. Truong, your house has already been sold. You're being sued in an unlawful detainer. And let me tell you about the unlawful detainer law. I'm happy to go to court. I'm happy to represent you. I'm happy to do what I can. But unfortunately, the unlawful detainer statute doesn't allow us to do much."
The unlawful detainer statute requires a trial de novo.
Yes, Your Honor.
And in this case, there was no request for a trial de novo within 10 days?
There was not.
And so doesn't that preclude an appeal to this court?
No, Your Honor, and there's 2 reasons why. The first one is we're challenging the validity of a statute.
I understand that, but you characterize the trial de novo as an appeal to the circuit court, and it is a new trial, which is not an appeal. And so if, in fact, he did not take advantage of that opportunity, then why does that not, because it doesn't matter whether it's constitutional or not, if it's not a final judgment appropriately following, then there is no appeal to any court, is there?
There is an appeal to this court via 512-180. And we have met the requirements of that statute, because the statute reads, "Any person aggrieved by a judgment in a civil case tried without a jury shall have a right to a trial de novo." From the outset, we requested a trial by jury. We just never made it to the jury stage.
Do you have any cases that say that support your position?
Well, actually, VFW and Greenbrier, both cited by the respondent, give us that exact language.
Does it say, with your facts, that the request for a jury trial, when there is none, is treated as a jury trial?
No. What it does characterize is that a trial de novo exists when there's been a bench trial, and that is when that right exists.
But that's what you had. You said you did not have a jury trial.
We did not have a jury trial.
So why didn't you have to ask for a trial de novo?
Because we had a summary judgment that precluded a trial by jury.
Is a summary judgment appropriate in rent possession cases? Of course, they under the Silverblatt Realty case, they said you couldn't have a jury trial under magistrate court in rent possession, but unlawful detainer is that exception in law which says you have a right to a jury trial.
Yes.
Does summary judgment wipe out your right to a jury trial?
Yes, it does.
Why couldn't you?
Why would it wipe it out if you have that absolute right to a jury trial? I had cases where I had no defense whatsoever, and I tried it to a city jury, and lo and behold, the city jury didn't throw my clients out. There was no defenses whatsoever, but the case was before. But, you know, why can't you have a jury trial?
Well,
there's no formal pleading in Associate Circuit Court.
No, and the summary judgment struck.
Why is that appropriate when you have an absolute right to a jury trial in an unlawful detention. That's the only remedy you have is your jury trial.
Yes. The only, and we requested one, but the summary judgment was issued.
But a trial de novo, you get to start all over, and you could ask for a jury trial and could have had one. That's the remedy, and you didn't seek it.
That's a remedy for a bench trial.
But you did not have a jury trial. Unless you have a jury trial, the statutes are clear. I'm not hearing
anything from you that says they're not. Is the summary judgment, did you really have a trial and you have a summary judgment?
I mean, I would, summary judgment typically precludes, I mean, I've had this happen in other cases where I've had a party out on a case via summary judgment. I still had remaining parties with which I had to try in front of the jury. And my recourse wasn't until the trial was over that I could then find out whether or not I had rights against the party that was let go in summary judgment. And I think that exists here. We were told we didn't have evidence that in fact, I mean, even though it's disputed in the record, that in fact the judge was unable to listen to our evidence, consider our evidence, in fact struck our evidence, and said that he could decide the merits based on the pleadings.
And why didn't you then ask for trial de novo in the circuit court?
Well, both reasons. First of all, by reading the Constitution, since we knew we were attacking, and we had been from the outset, the constitutionality of the statute.
But as Judge Breckenridge points out, that's for appeals.
And then the 512.180. And our interpretation of that statute was that since we had not had a bench trial,
What does the statute say? Does it say if you have a bench trial?
Yes.
Or does it say unless you have a jury trial?
It says any person aggrieved by a judgment in a civil case tried without a jury before an associate circuit judge shall have a right to a trial de novo.
And that doesn't apply to you? You don't think?
No.
Your case wasn't tried without a jury?
No, it was a decision made by a judge.
So it'd be you'd ask us it sounds like it's a first impression issue. You're saying that if you get summary judgment and rather than a bench trial or a jury trial, that it should, the trial de novo statute doesn't apply. Are there any cases that have applied it in that situation that you're familiar with?
I think the area is a little gray. I think if you looked at VFW and Greenbrier, the language indicates that review is a trial de novo. It's a complete review. It is essentially an appeal, and that's how we took it based on 512.
But even if you had a trial de novo, you still wouldn't have the rights. It would be the same unlawful detainer.
Exactly.
Statute.
It'd be the same procedure.
You would
procedure.
Still have the same lack of rights, lack of protestation that you would think you're arguing about your due process. Even if it's a trial de novo in the circuit court, would be futile.
Yes, I mean, nothing would be different.
I didn't mean to interrupt. It's more like an exhaustion of your available remedies issue. In other words, if you lose at summary judgment, you know, do you have to request a trial de novo to raise these issues again in order to appeal it to the next level?
No. I think what is at issue here is that we filed the appeal with this court based on the validity of the statute, but I don't think we were required, since we are not having a, I mean, we requested a trial by jury. We wanted a trial by jury, and we were cut short of that. But I don't know that that's a bench
trial. Did the judge order you did not have a right to a jury?
I'm going to turn it over.
Well, a summary judgment, I guess, was the...
Your Honor, John Campbell, we understood that at about 4 minutes we'd switch, even if we were on this issue, because I'm also prepared to discuss it. I'd start, Your Honor, to answer your question. We were set for a jury trial. We wanted a jury trial for the very reason you expressed. We wanted a jury to consider this issue. The judge granted a summary judgment and denied us a jury trial, and then we went to 512.180 and we read it. And it says, any person aggrieved by a judgment in a civil case tried without a jury shall have a trial de novo. We asked, was our case tried without a jury? The answer is no. Our case wasn't tried at all. Our case was decided on summary judgment because the statute said, even though all the evidence, which is to this date undisputed, is that this is Mr. Truong's home and that he was not in default and the foreclosure was void.
So
even though all the evidence says that.
So a summary judgment is not a trial by a bench trial?
It isn't, Your Honor. I've never heard anybody say, I tried my case at summary judgment. A summary judgment precludes you from trying the case.
And if you went on trial de novo, you'd have to come up with double the rent or double the money until the case was heard. You're not relieved of that responsibility.
Well, and I think 512180 actually contemplates what you just said. The second part also carves out situations where you don't need a trial de novo. And here's what it says. If the case has been assigned to be heard on the record under procedures applicable before circuit judges, then you don't have a trial de novo. Well, what do we have here? The law, 517021.
Your opponent says there was no assignment to a judge.
Your Honor, I've searched the case law. There is no definition of the word assignment in case law that I can find. I can say this. The law required Judge Dick Hayner to hear this case under the Missouri Rules of Civil Procedure. Nobody disputes that. And nobody disputes
well,
there was a record.
You're wanting us to technically apply the law about trial de novo, but you're not wanting us to technically apply the law, the other law, that says it's an assigned judge.
Well, I mean, Your Honor, I guess we're arguing about what an assignment is. Mm-hmm. I mean, 517021 says this judge, the associate circuit judge in this case, must apply the rules of the circuit court, which I read as an assignment. I mean, he had no option to do anything other than apply the civil rules.
And if you're incorrect on that and it's a procedural mechanism that the court's procedural rules address how you assign someone to hear a case as a circuit judge, then does that, if you're incorrect that this was tried as if tried by a circuit judge, does that undercut your argument?
Well, it would only undercut the second part of this argument, which is we've met both the exemptions in 512180. And, Your Honor, I would just point out, I mean, I don't want to concede the point that a trial de novo is not an appeal. Everybody, when I talk to people, they say if you lose at the Associate Circuit Court, you often have the right to appeal and have a trial de novo. And the case law talks about a trial de novo as a fast and dirty appeal. It is, if we look at the definition of an appeal in Black's Law Dictionary, what is an appeal? It is a review by another court of a previous decision.
But you don't review it. You should have de novo.
Well, but you do, Your Honor, because, for instance, if I brought a case to this court and the standard of review was de novo, this court would look at it brand new.
We review the record made below, and we look at it, the law de novo, or look at. But in the circuit court, you don't look at what was introduced below. You make an entirely new record. It's very different.
I understand, Your Honor, and my time has exceeded. If I could just respond
Please,
briefly.
Absolutely.
This is the other challenge that Judge Teitelman is addressing, and I recognize the law does not have a case on this. If we, in a second case, we sought a trial de novo and appealed to this court because we didn't know what else to do. We thought, if we're wrong, we need a trial de novo. The case was assigned to another associate circuit judge to hear it under identical rules that were already applied in the first case, with the same restrictions on what evidence we could present. And the risk to our client was they're facing double damages for an extra 90 or 180 days. And so we had to make a decision, and we said, we're challenging the validity of a statute. That's ultimately got to be this court and only this court that can issue that decision. 512180, its plain meaning is, unless the case was tried without a jury. No one disputes this case was never tried without a jury. It was not tried without a jury. It wasn't a bench trial. It was set for jury. And so here's where we're at. If we can't be here, it means if you demand a jury trial and you get it, you don't need a trial de novo. If you demand a jury trial and a law cuts in and forces the court to grant summary judgment, you need a trial de novo. And I think that would be a very confusing result for practicing attorneys.
But there's another issue about unlawful detainers and exclusive. Usually you can bring a case in circuit court like an ejectment, or you can bring it in the Associate Circuit Court. Unlawful detainers is exclusively the jurisdiction of the Associate Circuit Court. I'm not sure how much that you can just take it up to the Circuit Court.
Your Honor, what you've expressed is true. When we tried to take it up as a trial de novo in another case, we ended up in front of another Associate Circuit judge under the identical rules. I simply don't know how seeking a trial de novo does anything, right, except delay and cost my client a lot of money when we know that the validity of a statute. I mean, let's face it, the Associate Circuit Court is not going to decide the validity of the statute. This court is, and only this court has the authority to do it.
It's not double the damages at the time of the judgment. It's double damages as the rent keeps accruing.
Until there's a final decision.
So, counsel, are you saying that any time the Associate Circuit Court rules on a matter without a trial, without a jury, just makes maybe a judgment on the pleadings, somewhat as the summary judgment was done here, that the remedy is then, if you're challenging the validity of a statute, a direct appeal to this court?
Well, Your Honor, if it's the validity of a statute, this court has exclusive original appellate jurisdiction, so yes, we could never wind up anywhere else.
But there's no requirement to go through the trial de novo stage.
No, Your Honor, there isn't. And the plain meaning of 512180 is that the only time you need a trial de novo is when a case is tried without a jury. And I think the obvious reason is there wasn't a record often. Often they're informal in associate circuit court. And I would look at the indicia in this case. We've got a record. We've got hundreds of pages of briefing. We've got a demand for a jury trial. We've got everything needed to review a case. And the request by appellant would be we go do it again in front of another associate circuit judge under the same rules.
Are the facts truly undisputed such that this is just a question of law that's presented for resolution?
Well, Your Honor, that's an interesting question that gets to the nut of this case. I would say, you know, the undisputed evidence is what you heard. Mr. Truong paid. He wasn't in default. The law is very clear. If you have a foreclosure sale and there's no default, it is void. All right, Spires says that, lights out, it's void, it never happened. Similarly, if the trustee was inappropriate, which in this case the trustee worked for the lender and also worked for the party who bought it at the sale, well, you know, West Quincy Auto says if the trustee is not appropriate, the sale is void. And so what we submitted is evidence that to this day has never been denied that says that this foreclosure sale is void, and the trustee's sale is void, and title never passed to Fannie Mae. And so what we have is Fannie Mae, right now, the evidence this court has to take as true is Fannie Mae has our client's home. It's been taken illegally. And the answer is the because of the unlawful detainer statute, the associate circuit judge couldn't consider that. And so what he did was he took all that evidence, threw it out, and said, as a result, it's undisputed evidence from Fannie Mae because quite literally, no matter what evidence you put in, I can't read it. I can't consider any evidence on title.
And you agree you could bring all that up in a separate action, but your argument is that that's not fair because in the meantime your client is unable to stay in their home.
Well, yes. I mean, if I were to say, Mr. Truong, don't worry, we can bring a separate action, which is what we told him we have to do right now. His answer is, okay, but they've already thrown me out of my house, and I might be out of it for years, or what's more likely is his house will be sold to another purchaser, and we'll never be able to put this thing back together again. And so, you know, to suggest that telling Mr. Truong, you lost your house and that's not fair, and Fannie Mae took it, you know, bought it, and City Mortgage took it and shouldn't have, but hey, the good news is 2 years from now you can have a case where you prove it's actually your house. It'll be too late to get it back, and your stuff's already been thrown out, and you had to move, but that's an adequate remedy at law. This is an embarrassment to the law. You know,
well, could you, if you can't put any defenses forward, can you actually contest a summary judgment?
No, Your Honor, this is the thing. If Mr. Truong had
another example, if I took a piece of property that Judge Russell had, sued someone and say, I want you out of the property, and I didn't own it, I could do that on a lawful detainer and get a judgment?
Your Honor, absolutely, Your Honor. I mean,
well, there was already a foreclosure, which he didn't defend. Is that correct?
Well, and of course, it's a nonjudicial foreclosure. And when he walked into the office, which is a 20-day process, the foreclosure sale had occurred. And so the only issue is, if we know that a foreclosure sale that's inappropriate is void, and if there's nothing in the law that says he can't challenge it now, he can. If it's void, title never passed. And the party standing up in the unlawful detainer saying, give me the house, Fannie Mae, has no legal title. It is void. It is as if it never occurred. And so they're demanding possession to property that they don't have a right to.
You'd have to bring a separate declaratory judgment or some other action to say it's void?
Yes. I mean, the way the law stands right now, we have to split the litigation and go file an affirmative action about why it's void. And by the time we prove it's void, which I'm convinced we will in this case, we'll prove it's his home. He will have not had his home for years because the unlawful detainer statute says to Judge Dickhainer, who, to his credit, said, I don't like this law. I think it lets you usurp property. I'm deeply concerned about it. I hope the appellate court looks at it. But he had to enforce it the way he understood it, which was, I guess I have to give Fannie Mae the house.
But he didn't have to prove he owned the property. A stranger to the property couldn't come in and throw you out. You're simply saying his proof was the judgment he got in foreclosure, and you think you can set that aside in a separate action, but you haven't done so yet.
Your Honor, you can't set it aside that fast. I mean, the problem is,
But it's not that they did it with no evidence. He presented proof of ownership.
Well,
you're saying. It's unfair that the unlawful detainer statute does not let you show that that proof was invalid.
That's right, Your Honor. It's the only case I know of where the plaintiff wins with any proof at all and the defendant loses without being heard. I mean, if they submitted a title in crayon, and I'm not suggesting they did, but if they submitted a title in crayon, the law says we can't challenge it. The judge could look at it and say, this is patently false.
Well, the real problem is you can't stay the detainer.
And we can't stay the detainer. And in fact, even the trial judge who's hearing the detainer is not allowed to stay his own case under appellate law. And we've had situations, including the Smith case that we referenced in our brief, where we filed an affirmative action. We said, please stay that unlawful detainer so we don't lose the house before we figure out the title. And the judge said, I can't stay it. And so what happens? The client loses the house before we know whose house it is. This is, I don't think anybody disputes this. If Mr. Truong owns the home, he should keep it. And if Fannie Mae legally owns the home, they should keep it. Now, and the problem is we don't find out.
I'm sorry to interrupt.
No, thank you.
Your opponent argues that, and I know you all didn't get in the case till much later, but your opponent argues that your client could have enjoined the foreclosure proceeding before it happened and raised all these defenses then. And I know you all weren't in the case, but isn't that the problem here?
It's not true that you can enjoin. Is the question that we could have enjoined the foreclosure proceeding?
Yes. Mm-hmm. That's what he says.
Well, I can tell you that I've tried to do that, and I've done that in cases where they got to me early enough. And you have to go and prove that you're likely to win on the merits. You have to seek a TRO. And then you have to turn it into a preliminary injunction. And then the judge usually says, I need bond. And that bond, in a case my wife handled, was $10,000 to a person who was already dead broke. They couldn't post the bond. They still lost the house. And
but
so
the assumption is everyone has the money to do whatever. The assumption is you can pay double rent. And that's all good. The law says pay double rent and the income of whatever bond they have, that's okay if you have that money. If you don't have the money, you're out of luck.
No, it's absolutely true. And Your Honor, I suggest we're not challenging the double rent provision. And so what would have happened if we'd done it right? If we found out if this is Mr. Truong's home or Fannie Mae's home first? Well, if Mr. Truong's wrong and this isn't his house, Fannie Mae gets the house, Mr. Truong leaves, and what do they get? Not just damages, double damages for however long it took to sort it out. What we've done instead is we've said we want it quick. And, you know, quick and wrong is okay. I don't believe that expediency is a substitute for
but
justice.
If they didn't have title, can you sue Fannie Mae to get, are they bankrupt? Could you sue Fannie Mae and get their and get damages?
We have sued Fannie Mae in the affirmative action to attempt to get damages, but it won't give Mr. Truong his home. And there's no amount of money that will give him back the place where he raised his kids. I mean, he has no adequate remedy at law unless this law is changed. I'm sorry to be so far over, but thank you for listening.
Thank you. Mr. Walsh.
May it please the court.
Did you have Oval Phipps? Did he teach you about the season stuff?
Yes, he did. But I've forgotten it all.
It's an honest answer.
Thank you.
At the outset, there are two jurisdictional problems with this case, one of which has been alluded to, and that's the trial de novo, which nine decisions in the various courts of appeals have held that where you have a disposition by the Associate Circuit Court in unlawful detainer, your only remedy is a trial de novo.
Was this summary judgment as opposed to a bench trial? And does the de novo statute apply to that?
Yeah, they don't differentiate. I think most of these cases go on summary judgment, and there's never been any real discussion about. I would say it's a disposition by the Associate Circuit Judge without a trial, and the purpose of going to a trial de novo is to make a record so that when it does go up on appeal, the court has a record to review rather than just a paper trail. And there's nine, as I say, there's nine cases from the various courts of appeals that have held that the only remedy is trial de novo. And in this case, the Associate Circuit Judge specifically said to these folks, now, you know, when you're through here, you've got to go to the circuit court. You can't go directly to the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court. And they ignored that. There's also a problem with the absence of the Attorney General in this case. I'm not the official spokesman for the state of Missouri. When the constitutional challenge is made to the statutes of this state, Section 527.110 and Rule 8704 say the Attorney General must be a participant.
Well, opposing counsel says that's only when they file a declaratory judgment action, and here they were attacking it through the unlawful detainer.
Well, they're asking you to declare the statute unconstitutional. They pleaded in the Associate Circuit Court a counterclaim for a declaratory judgment saying that they wanted the whole statutory scheme to be set aside and their title to be made good. The LCRA case said the participation of the Attorney General is mandatory. That section of our statute is the same as Section 11 of the Uniform Declaratory Judgment Acts. And we cite nine cases in our brief where other states applying exactly the same provision have held that the appellate court has no jurisdiction without the participation of the Attorney General. Now, if you get to the merits, there's also a couple rather gigantic hurdles that plague plaintiffs or appellant's case. First, there's the Howlett and Scott cases involving Fannie Mae from the 1970s, where the court held, this court unanimously in bank, held that the non-judicial foreclosure aspects of Missouri law do not implicate state action, and therefore there is no constitutional violation because it's not state action. That's four square holding. Fannie Mae was even the party in that case. The theory is, and this is an analysis by Judge Finch of a lot of U.S. Supreme Court cases, the analysis is that while the unlawful detainer statutes are there for use by repossessing lenders and landlords, the state is not so significantly involved in the actual proceedings as to constitute state action. There must be, in the words of the U.S. Supreme Court, a symbiotic relationship between the state and the private actor, and the mere fact that the statutes are there, like a lot of statutes are there that authorize private action, does not mean that the use of non-judicial foreclosure is state action. The court said it's based on the contract between the parties, primarily, and the fact that the statutes exist do not mean that state action exists, and therefore there's a constitutional question. Those holdings are directly on point and must be dealt with if you get to the constitutional issue, and stare decisis would suggest that that's very strong stuff. Then also, the U.S. Supreme Court has weighed into this very issue back in the 70s, 1972, in Lindsay versus Normet, 405 U.S. 52, and it analyzed the Oregon unlawful detainer statute, which for all intents and purposes is exactly the same as ours. It limited the analysis to the right to possession and the holding over by the tenant. It was a landlord-tenant analysis, but it applies fully in the foreclosure context too, particularly since the deed of trust in this particular case creates a landlord and tenant relationship between lender and borrower in paragraph 24 of the deed of trust. But, and they, in their reply brief, they say, well, that case isn't really applicable because it only dealt with landlord-tenant and not foreclosure. But one of the cases cited by Justice White in Lindsay was the case of Bianchi versus Morales, which was decided by Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes in 1923, and he specifically held that, in that case, the Puerto Rico unlawful detainer statute, which had the same kinds of provisions that we're talking about here, did not violate due process. There's a long history at common law for limiting unlawful detainer type actions to the issue of possession only. And that,
so is there simply no remedy for the situation opposing counsel's discussed, where you have to end up being out of your home and just hope 2 years later you get enough money to buy a new one?
Well, let's talk about what he did or didn't do. Now, he was originally sent a notice of default on August 4th of 2010. And that notice of default said, if you have any questions regarding foreclosure proceedings, call the above lawyer. He didn't do that. All he had to do was call the lawyer and say, hey, I've got this modification thing going on here that you may not know
about.
When
was the foreclosure? How long after that?
It was on September 10th.
So less than a month.
Yeah. Now, on August 9th, he got a notice of foreclosure from the trustee. And that notice said, under federal law, you have 30 days to contest this notice. If there are some facts that we should know about that we don't, bring them to our attention, we'll investigate them. If you're not in default, fine, you know, we'll deal with it. No response.
Now was that mailed certified mail? Was it mailed regular mail? How was that notification given?
It was in his mailbox when he got home. He was out of the country is the reason why he didn't get this stuff, at least that's what he says. That's not our fault. We did everything we could to notify him and say, you know, is there something about this we should know to stop this foreclosure?
Say we had a situation, which I understand you don't believe occurred here, that he did call and he did notify them and so forth, and they said, oh, too bad, we're going ahead with the foreclosure. What remedy would he have?
Well, he could enjoin the foreclosure. You can always file an equitable action before the foreclosure, which happens all the time, and the judge will decide, you know, is foreclosure justified under these facts.
Do you agree that there were undisputed facts upon which to grant a summary judgment in this case?
Absolutely. The only issue in unlawful detainer is the right to possession and the holding over by the borrower. The right to possession is established by the trustee's deed. There was never any claim that the trustee's deed was in crayon or otherwise defective. It was signed by the trustee, and the procedure was regular. And for him to say that the foreclosure proceedings are void is just nonsense. I mean, it's presumptively valid until somebody sets it aside. And now his argument is that he was operating under this temporary modification agreement, which is true. But the temporary modification agreement said all terms and conditions of the loan documents remain in full force and effect, and there be no modification to the underlying obligation until a permanent loan modification agreement is signed by both parties. And, in all caps, time is of the essence. Well, while he was out of the country, he apparently received a permanent modification form for him.
Did he ever come back to tell you, well, gee, I got these letters, but I was out of the country, what can I do? Or is,
well, that's his claim, that's his claim now, yes.
He came back after the foreclosure had occurred, I take it.
He said the day before. But this permanent modification agreement has written all over it, take prompt action. Send us your payment and this signed agreement by September 1st. Again, he missed another opportunity to save himself all this trouble. He did not sign it. He never signed it. The agreement was never modified. He was in default. There was nothing irregular about the foreclosure proceeding. And you know, for him to argue that it's...
Were all those papers also sent while he was out of the country?
Well, it was dated October 4th. He claimed he was out, August 4th.
Thank you.
August 4th. He claimed he was gone during the month of August. Of course, that's just his statement, but he was gone probably for at least 6 weeks. Mm-hmm. At a time when all this very sensitive financial stuff is going on, and he made no arrangements for anybody to monitor his mail or take care of what turned
that's
out to be a
problem. That's what I meant. He had notice of the need to work out a new arrangement and so forth before he left. He was involved.
He knew that this had to become permanent before there would be
that
any.
All occurred before.
Yeah, it's not your responsibility. You're just mailbox before they get the notice, and that's it.
Well, we were required to give him notice. There's never been any claim that the notice given him was invalid or defective. It was in his mailbox when he got home, but he wasn't there when the time, which was of the essence, was passing by. These statutes that they're trying to set aside here have been on the books of this state since 1885. And they've also been on the statutes of almost every other state in the Union forever, back from the common law. There's no case anywhere that has ever set aside an unlawful detainer scheme like we have here on the basis of any constitutional impediment. As a matter of fact, other than the two Fannie Mae cases in the 1970s from this court, we've been unable to find any attempt to in any state to make such an attack. But primarily, I suppose, because Lindsay against Norman in the U.S. Supreme Court says there's no equal protection problem, there's no due process problem. Equal protection doesn't apply because all tenants, all holdovers are treated equally, and unfair classification is between them and other defendants. And there's a rational basis for having this swift procedure to restore possession to the party properly entitled to it. And that is, at common law, apparently, the right of repossession under these circumstances was the right of self-help. And as Justice White points out in the Lindsay case, that frequently escalated into a tiff or even violence. And so the judicial imprimatur of the unlawful detainer statutes gave an orderly process to restore title on a prompt basis and also keep order. And likewise, the court said there is no due process problem because, although they claim here they had no right to a hearing, they had a right to several hearings. They could have, as I said before, have sued to enjoin the foreclosure. The judge in the unlawful detainer action at one point said, I'll tell you what I'm going to do, because you've made all these assertions, I'm going to stay the unlawful detainer action for 30 days to allow you to take your claim to circuit court and ask the circuit court to deal with it. They didn't avail themselves of that opportunity. So who's, you know, who's responsible for creating this mess? And they had all kinds of opportunities to avoid it, and yet did not take any action, and they say this is way out of control. Well, you know, let's look at what they didn't do to help themselves.
Is the offer to stay the detainer in the record there?
Oh, yes. Yes. It's one of his orders.
But he'd have to come up with a bond to stay in the property.
I don't know about that at that stage, because it was in the middle of the unlawful detainer action. There hadn't been any ruling yet. So
the judge was just going to continue the case for 30 days. He was just going to wait 30 days to rule on it?
He said,
I'll further hear it?
Yeah, well, I assume that if they'd gone ahead, he might have continued to stay. I don't know. We'll never know because they
didn't. You mean filed a separate action because they couldn't take this up to circuit?
Right, okay. Right.
Which was obviously the rational basis of moving these properties along quickly and having but that was the case, I think, when Professor Peter Salsik, not that a professor, 69, wrote a case in this court, and in this court said, no, you're allowed to have notices when you have an eviction. Somehow they're allowed to have notices of the evictioners before throwing their goods and their furniture in the street. And actually this court itself said you're allowed to have notices, and they changed the process so that even though it would be slower, you couldn't take your property self-help so easily. This court actually decided you probably remember the case, you were probably back in those days, but Peter Salsik actually was a new lawyer and he brought that case. And
I've known him for 55 years. But
I know.
But there's no claim in this case about inadequacy of notice. I mean, the notice was adequate. It was there. He wasn't. That's the problem. That's how this all started. By my count, in order to rule in favor of the appellant in this case, this court would have to overrule 12 cases on the books in this state, and would also have to differentiate itself from the Supreme Court's analysis in Lindsay on the basis that our Equal Protection Clause is somehow stronger than the federal Equal Protection Clause, and our Due Process Clause covers more than the Federal Due Process Clause. And of course, those kinds of statements are contrary to rulings of this court forever, that our Due Process and Equal Protection Clauses are coextensive with the federal clauses.
Very well argued, Mr. Walsh. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming back for rebuttal.
Mrs. Campbell.
Yes.
But, you know, 1885 was a long time ago. It was before the Lochner Court. It was before child labor laws. I mean, the world has evolved a long time, a lot since those days. And so may we. Go ahead.
Does the record reflect the trial court in this case gave a stay for purposes of going to circuit court to seek an injunction or to set aside the foreclosure?
Judge Decaner offered a stay.
Okay.
However, he has no authority to issue a stay.
Well, I understand he may not have, but the record does reflect that he did offer to give you a stay in this case.
Had he entered his judgment yet?
I mean, no, he had not.
So his language of stay may have meant I'm just going to delay
making a ruling.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and I would.
Which he did have authority to do.
Yes, he did. Because he made his summary judgment ruling shortly after that.
You mean shortly after how long he said he would wait, or?
Yes.
Shortly after he found
after
out that you
wanted. After
the 30 days. Okay. So he said he was going to give your client 30 days to file a separate action, and in fact he did.
Yes, he did. I want to respond to a few things that have been said, though. For example, the facts, whether or not my client received notices, whether or not he was in the country to read those notices, call those phone numbers. We've talked more about that here than I was allowed to talk about in the unlawful detainer action, which I find to be interesting, because those things couldn't even be talked about there. We could not even find out what City Mortgage knew, what my client knew. All of that was kept out.
But opposing counsel's point is you could have talked about it in a separate action had you brought one, but you chose not to do so.
Right. And our reason for that was simply because that does not get Mr. Truong his house back. And that's what we found flawed with the statute, is this is the chance to get it right. This is the chance to see whether or not they have possession, and possession turns on ownership. So let's find out if Fannie Mae actually owns the house, because if they do, Mr. Truong should leave. If Mr. Truong owns the house, he should stay. And finding that out in an affirmative action several years later, after he's already out of the house, after his possessions are already gone, we can't fix that then. Additionally, Lindsay also states that due process requires that there be an opportunity to present every available defense, another thing that Mr. Truong was unable to do. Our counterclaims were stricken, our defenses were stricken, everything we provided the court was not considered and was not allowed.
Do we have to find our state constitutional provisions are broader than the federal ones interpreted in the cases relied on by opposing counsel to rule for you?
No, Your Honor, because this isn't even 100 years of precedent that we're dealing with. This portion of the statute was added in 1997, where it specifically applies to people who are in after a foreclosure sale. The legislature put that in, and it's in 1997. So the previous years of case law is all based on the landlord-tenant scenario, where you have a private contract.
Well, let me ask you this question about it. You raise a good point about the defenses. Do you have to be able to bring your defenses in the action that's brought against you versus saying you have to bring another action? You have to take the affirmative act to bring another action to actually get your case heard,
and
your
that's
issues heard. Should you have the right to bring forward your defenses and the action that brings you to court versus having to bring another action to try to assert your rights?
Yes, and I'm going to go probably over time just a bit, but yes, every other defendant in Missouri has the right to show up in court and defend their position, to look at the evidence provided by the plaintiff, and to put plaintiff to its proof. In this scenario, Mr. Truong is not allowed to question any of that.
Has any court found an unlawful detainer statute unconstitutional for due process or equal protection violation?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the argument.
Mr.